money here. I had a good fortune to bump into the poet Derek Mann, who told me he'd just come back from Russia. So, for Derek Mann and all the wonderful books he has composed and published, I want to read this piece called Diarrhea Attack at Party Headquarters in Leningrad. An attack of diarrhea at party headquarters in Leningrad was not something I imagined ever happening to me, which is perhaps partly why it did happen to me. The Presidium had barely taken its place under the iconic portraits of V.I. Lenin and M.S. Gorbachev, when I could feel the initial missiles firing down the sky of my stomach, setting in motion something that was irreversible, the realpolitik of the irreversible. The only consolation was that I was wearing underpants. The fact is that sometimes I do not wear underpants. Oddly enough, I was wearing red underpants, which I had originally purchased in Marks and Spencer's. The first explosion resulted in immediate devastation, the ensuing explosion serving only to define the innately irreversible dialectic of catastrophe. I whispered magnanimously into the earhole of my interpreter. He reciprocated that since he also had a trauma of the intestine, we should both take our leave immediately. And he showed me such fraternal solicitude that in my mind's eye, I can still see Lenin peering down at me, as if he were peering down at nobody else in the hall. A black Volga whisked us back to our hotel, and ignominy, my ignominy, not anybody else's ignominy. And that night, over cups of tea, we discussed the war in Afghanistan, agreeing that, realistically, it appeared an insoluble problem. Yet, hoping against hope, that somehow it would be solved. And that, as you put it, Slava, Russian boys come home, there is nothing necessarily ignominious about anything. There's an assassination, torture, stalked the land. The night they murdered Boyle Somerville, as I was travelling one morning in an empty carriage on a train passing south through the west, a small old woman with her husband, who was smaller, hobbled in, shut the door and sat down. They told me they were going home to Skibbereen, that they were old age pensioners and proud of it, enjoying free travel up and down the country. They sat down opposite me and we conversed when it suited us. Such was the ease with which we comported our silences. Outside, the fields in their summer lay on their sides in the sun, their season of flashing over. Nor did we evade each other's eyes, nor pronounce solutions to the awful war in progress, except by a sign language acknowledging that here was the scar that lay inside the self-betrayal beyond all shattering. And all this ease, and all this somber wisdom came, not from me who am not by nature wise, but from the true old age pensioners and their senators. He was a king figure from out the island, short-shouldered man, the globe of a skull, whose lips were the lips of an African chieftain, having that expression from which there is no escape, a gaze, interrupted only by the ritual blowing of an ancient pipe. His wife, being a queen, told him to put away his pipe. Did he not see the sticker on the window pane? It said, "No cock to bock." But he did not hear. No more than he heard the ticket inspector, who, having failed to draw attention to the warning notice, withdrew apologetically, apologizing for the intrusion. So, while the old man blew on his walnut plug, his wife gazed out the window, and so did I. When she spoke of the old times, and the scoriae back at Skibbereen, and of the new times, and the new words. "Ah, but," he interposed, glaring out into the blue-walled sky, "I found out what was in it, and was not in it, the night they murdered Boyle Somerville. I knew then that it was only the sky had a roof,